Good day, folks. This is a podcast runs through it, episode 27. If you've been following along, this is the third in our series of the Montana 2020 general election series. Dixie and I are here to help you along. Hi, Dixie.
Hello, Nelson.
We're covering the main state offices and national offices from Montana, mainly because we want people to be informed and be ready to vote not only on the offices up and down the slate, but also know who the candidates are, what they stand for, and why you're voting or not voting for somebody. Today's episode, part three, covers the Public Service Commission and the U.S. Representative of the House, Montana at large. In other words, the representative. And both of these races are important, but I think that perhaps the Public Service Commission is the one that's least understood. And we'll try to cover some of the, what do these people do? What are these offices about as we get into each of them and discuss the candidates? We have one kind of piece of business to take care of today. We have an endorsement to take care of first, which we are not covering the Supreme Court candidates in this in our episodes, and we would like to mention, of course, that there is an election for Supreme Court positions, and we'd like to make an endorsement. Dixie, you wanted to describe that a little bit?
Yes, we'd just like to say that we stand with five former Montana Supreme Court members in our endorsement for Montana Supreme Court candidate Mike Black. We endorse him because he has a strong record of fighting dark money. He supports public lands and his support of free and fair elections.
And we'd like to emphasize that, unlike federal court positions, this is an elected position. And the Supreme Court of Montana is a very important court. It takes second place only to the Supreme Court of the United States. So, again, we remind people that that's on the ballot, and we're making an endorsement for the one position, Mike Black. So, before we get started with today's specific offices, a couple of points we'd like to make. I think I'm trying to make people aware of the fact that because of the environment we're in now with the coronavirus crisis and the economic crisis and the, I guess you could call it the racial justice, injustice crisis and the climate crisis, that we have so many things happening right now that politics itself is in turmoil. So we need to kind of put that in perspective, that when we listen to candidates in particularly September and October, that they have in fact started to talk about the actual situation we're in. Dixie, maybe we can get into the area without going into great detail, but where we are now with the issue of mail-in voting and voter suppression.
Right. Yes. Of course, we've all heard Donald Trump talking about the terrible threat of mail-in voting and how it's all part of a grand scheme to undermine and the election process. And we'd just like to remind folks that this is an old trope. It's been used before. Probably not by the President of the United States as openly as he is, but it is just another part of the dirty tricks campaign that we're having to deal with on top of the real issues that we're all facing as a country.
Yeah, and we want people to be aware that one of the overarching techniques here is what we call gaslighting. In other words, casting doubt on something. I mean, the whole point of perhaps for some of this activity, talking about destroying the post office and sabotaging the mail, is not so much that they will actually be able to do that, but that they want people to think that they can. They want people to believe that they shouldn't trust the mail in order to send in their ballots. And that's called gaslighting.
Right. But what they are doing is actually slowing down the process of mail delivery. And I think the Democrats demonstrated that quite well in the Senate hearings on Friday, where if you look, there's a noticeable dip in mail delivery that occurred in July after they started removing letter sorting machines and the blue postal collection boxes. And, you know, so, you know, we do need to pay attention to this. The threat is real, but it's the way it's being framed by the Republicans is this is just another Democratic hoax. And like Nelson said, this is all just a part of making people question the authenticity of the election. And, you know, as far as voter fraud, according to the very conservative Heritage Foundation, they did a study, and it shows that in over 20 years of voting in the United States, the percentage of voter fraud is 0.0006%. So this is not a real threat.
No, and it's not expected to be for this election either. But it is possible for the mail to be held up and for some states not to count the vote, which kind of brings up the point that we want to make consistently in all of our episodes that, you know, when you get your ballot, which in Montana is going to be around October 10th, fill it out, send it in, or take it to the recorder's office, because the sooner you get it in, the safer it is.
Right, right. And, you know, although, you know, another part of the dirty tricks, DeJoy, the Postmaster General, has said that he won't take any further actions to what he says reform the Postal Service. And although he made that public announcement, nothing has changed. It's just like when Trump said he was removing William Perry Pendley from nomination to head the Bureau of Land Management. Yes, he did remove his name from nomination, but Perry is still the acting director. So again, nothing changes.
Yeah.
Right. So what is it you like to say, Nelson? Pay attention to what they do, not what they say they're going to do.
That's particularly important right now.
Yes.
So all we can say is that things will change and that there will be new developments, I'm sure, as we go into the month of September and October, but it's up to the voters to do what they can do as soon as and as positively as they can. So, well, that having been said, I think we will get on to our main coverage here, which is the Public Service Commission office and the United States Representative for the House. The first office we're going to consider is the Montana Public Service Commission, or often referred to as simply the PSC. There are three seats that are up for election in this particular cycle, and we want people to understand a little bit about the PSC, because it's probably one of those agencies that many people don't vote for one way or the other, because they have no idea what it does. Public Service Commission, what does that mean? Well, basically, the Montana Public Service Commission is the one that you oversees and monitors and in some cases regulates the rates that people pay for the utility services. That would be for electricity, for water, for telephone in some cases, landlines anyway. And it is a kind of the watchdog primarily of the energy industry, which includes electrical and gas and oil and so forth. It has been and continues to be a very contentious, controversial agency, even though it's one of the smallest in government. And it regulates a number of things that people don't think much about. For example, it takes care of interstate or intrastate railroads. It covers some motor transport, you know, trucks hauling things from of certain regulated commodities. It oversees pipelines and safety regulations, and it also oversees the, as I mentioned, the utilities of the state, and it has quite a bit of power. The seats are, there are five districts, and three of them are up this year, and we will be covering one of them, the District 3, which is the south, mostly southwest of Montana. So with that having been said, the PSC Commission, or the Public Service Commission, the two candidates are, for the Democrats, Tom Woods, and for the Republicans, James Brown. Now, let's see. Dixie, do you want to start with James Brown? He's the Republican candidate. And give us a bit of a thumbnail on him.
Okay. He was born and raised in the Dillon area. He's got long-standing family roots in that area. He graduated in high school in 1989, which would, I guess, put his birth year at around 1971. I actually couldn't find out when he was born. He has a BA in political science and history from the University of Montana, and a JD from Seattle University School of Law, and has a master's in tax law from the University of Washington. He's a lawyer and he's a lobbyist. His law practices are in Dillon and in Helena. And as far as a legislative background, in 2012, he ran for the Public Service Commission, the same seat, and lost to the incumbent, Roger Koopman. Koopman has since been termed out, and that's why we have this open seat. And his other government experience, before attending law school, he worked as a congressional aide for 6 years in Washington, D.C., including working for Senator Conrad Burns. It's interesting because on his website, he says he has over 25 years of legislative and public policy experience, and yet he's never been elected to public office. So I guess he's referring to his time in D.C. and his lobbying work. And as far as his lobbying work, he and his clients include the Montana Independent Bankers, Montana Funeral Directors, and the Montana Wool Growers. He's also affiliated with Citizens for Balanced Use, which is described by the Campaign for Accountability as an anti-public lands nonprofit. The Campaign for Accountability has filed a complaint with the IRS against Citizens for Balanced Use for failing to report lobbying activity. And they've also filed a complaint against Citizens for Balanced Use, an ethics complaint against Montana House member Carrie White for violating state ethics laws by simultaneously serving as a state legislator and working as the executive director of Citizens for Balanced Use. So that's kind of a little interesting affiliation. The Citizens for Balanced Use, mostly they advocate for state control of federal lands. And their big position is that people should be able to use motorized vehicles and hunt on pretty much all public lands, and that public lands should be turned over to state authority so that they can be deregulated for that type of use. And they're also vehemently opposed to wilderness areas. And here are a few statements that Brown has made. He believes coal is a very good source of affordable energy, and it's a national security issue to make sure we have coal-fired generation and power supply in the United States. His law practice, he says, specializes in First Amendment protections against intrusions of government. He strongly believes in continuing Montana's natural resource development. And he says he's running to change Montana's regulatory environment that stands in the way of people creating jobs.
Yeah, I think the thumbnail can honestly be said that he's a fairly traditional, or in the modern sense of the conservative party, of a Tea Partier or a Trump supporter.
You know, one thing that that's of note is in the three open seats for the commission this year, there's District 2, 3, and 4 are all open. We do have some extremists running to try to get on that commission. So I think this is one where people should really be paying attention to not just the district that we're in, but what's happening overall with the Public Service Commission.
Okay. Moving from James Brown over to the Democratic candidate, Tom Woods. Tom Woods is probably fairly well known in this district. He was born in August 10th, 1961, which makes him 59 years old, and he was born in Cleveland. But he's been a Montana resident for quite a long time, lives in Bozeman, has a wife, Katie, and two children, Kelty and Finney and Fox. His current occupation, other than being a politician, is a college instructor at Montana State University. He's taught a lot of scientific fields such as biology, physics, cell biology, neuroscience. He's done that since 2001. So you can characterize him as somebody with an extensive scientific background, which...
Right. And, you know, another thing about Tom is he also teaches part-time for special needs students. And I've heard him talk about that, and he talks about just how it's such a rewarding experience for him.
No, as his political experience is pretty extensive. He first was elected to the Montana State House, District 64 in 2012, and he served that for 2 years. Then he ran again for the House in District 62, and that was 2014 to the present. And during that time, he was elected the caucus chair for the Montana House Democrats and has held that until presently. So he's been extremely active in the state legislature. So I would say when you characterize him, he's a Democrat with a really strong scientific background, an active four-term legislative history, including the chairman of the House Minority Caucus, and a consumer-centric Democrat with kind of, you would call it, bipartisan instincts. In other words, he highlights the fact that he likes to work on both sides of the aisle. If you'd like to hear a little bit from the candidate himself and maybe get a closer look at what he believes, we do have an episode of a podcast runs through it, episode 3.
Let's listen to a bit of that interview where he's giving an example of the dysfunctionality of the current PSC when they allowed Northwestern Energy to overvalue its assets, resulting in higher rates for Montana consumers.
What we're talking about here is overvaluation of assets. You know, the PSC grants the monopoly a return on equity. They get a certain percentage payment for what they own. And the PSC has approved the purchase of a number of different huge assets by Northwestern Energy. But that's fine. That's part of the job. But what has happened is that Northwestern Energy overvalued those assets. For example, the dams were probably worth about $635 million when Northwestern bought them, but there was a carbon valuation of about $275 million claimed by Northwestern that the PSC approved. They shouldn't have done that. The PSC should not have approved that. And we pay 11.5% on that value. So that's costing us tens of millions of dollars a year in overpayment. Same is true of Colstrip. You know, and I see that one as being even worse in that, you know, the company paid $187 million for Colstrip 4, for their share of Colstrip 4. They then went out and kind of shopped it around to different companies saying, hey, what's the value of this asset that we just bought? And they found a company that said, you know what, we would pay $407 million for Colstrip. And that's what Northwestern Energy brought before the PSC as the value of the asset. And that's what we pay 11.5% return on equity on every year. That's wrong. That's a sin of commission on Northwestern Energy's part. That was, you know, borderline fraud, as I say. And it's a sin of omission in that the PSC should never have approved it. And that's the kind of things that happen when we don't pay attention and when we have people in positions that really don't understand the balance between what's fair to the company and what's fair to the ratepayers. Mm-hmm.
I think this shows his depth of understanding about what the PSC's mission is, which basically is to regulate monopolies, and how the current PSC has strayed from that mission. And here I'll use one of his quotes, because I think it kind of summarizes where he's coming from. To quote, "The current PSC has a well-deserved, dismal reputation. From poor attendance at hearings on the part of some commissioners to the well-publicized episodes of bickering and spying between members, public perception of the PSC is that it is dysfunctional. Recent decisions to impose rate increases on homeowners and farmers while granting rate cuts to corporate box stores are evidence that the commission is deaf to the needs of regular Montanans. To be brutally honest, transparency and fairness have declined considerably under this commission." I think that he's coming from the position of as a well-known critic of the PSC, and has been the author of some legislation intended to try to correct some of the problems there. I think you can characterize him as a thorn in the side for the current commissioners. But it also means that he's extremely familiar with the issues. He's not coming into the PSC as a person who is on his way up to other places. He really is genuinely interested in how the PSC operates and its fairness. I would say that for him, a key issue is that the PSC is currently composed of 5 conservative Republican men, and they have a track record of supporting corporate interests, namely Northwestern Energy. And he is not running against, not only against that non-consumer-friendly commission, but he's running in favor of science and scientific economics principles to guide how utilities should be managed, and that the PSC should not be listening only to the development and corporate interests. And I think that's probably the number one issue for him, as it probably should be with the PSC. And as I mentioned, I think he brings a kind of deep knowledge to the climate crisis, and he wants to be that considered part of the PSC, which currently it's not. In fact, the current PSC commissioners wouldn't even bring climate change into their discussions, and he would like to change that. His listed priorities are energy conservation and the encouragement and development of smarter electrical grids, net metering, allowing people to generate their own electricity and sell it back, any surplus that they make, new energy opportunities, which obviously is solar and wind energy, for example, just and equal rates. And this was a priority as he was a legislature, which he would like to bring to the PSC. Energy assistance programs, which is the ability to fund low-income energy assistance. And finally, open access telecommunications. He would like to improve the ability of all Montanans to broadband and other forms of telecommunication. Those are his priorities for the commission. Finally, one more quote, I think, will kind of put his position in, what he brings to the table. Quote, "As a person who brought many, many bills to make utility regulation more fair to consumers, I'm feeling familiar with the laws governing utility regulation. I know where they've buried the bodies. As a 4-term legislature, I have a lot of experience parsing the competing arguments of attorneys and lobbyists. As a university physics instructor, I'm pretty darn familiar with the technical issues surrounding power distribution and generation. In my younger years, I ran businesses such as hotels and transportation companies, and I think I will bring a wealth of technical, legal, and business experience to the position." And I think that's a fair estimation. If you listen to his interview on a podcast, Ron Stewart, I think these are issues and qualities that come through very strongly for Tom Woods. What we'd like to do next is briefly, we think that running down some of the legislation that these candidates have supported or not supported is very useful in giving us a profile of what they really do. We want to make the distinction, particularly with politicians, that what they say is one thing and what they do legislatively is often different. So in this case, we're going to do a brief profile of Tom Woods based on the legislation that he has or has not supported. And I'll give you an example. We'll try to do this as concisely as possible, but try to give you a picture of what they actually do or do not support. For example, this is all legislation that has passed through or into the House in up in Helena in the Montana state government.
Right. And this, and these are all bills that actually came before the legislature while Tom was an active member of the state legislature.
Right. And while this isn't everything that he voted for, it does get, we are trying to give things that profile his position in the legislature. So, for example, the first one is amends state Medicaid program. In other words, support of state Medicaid. And yes, he voted for that. A bill requiring abortion providers to offer patients an ultrasound. He voted against that. Prohibits abortions after the 20th week of pregnancy. He voted against that.
He voted yes on a bill that prohibits suspension of driver's license as punishment for certain crimes. He also voted yes to a bill that prohibits employees from stopping employees from discussing wages. And he voted no on a bill that prohibits cities from passing sanctuary laws.
He was a co-sponsor of the bill for establishing presumptive health care coverage for firefighters. He also voted for revising programs, funds, and regulations related to invasive species. And he was a sponsor for the authorizing the Public Service Commission to approve cost tracking adjustments.
He voted against authorizing a postseason elk hunting. He voted yes on a bill that would prohibit bullying in public schools, which I think it was Austin Knutson that actually voted no on that one. He voted yes to expand health care coverage and yes on a bill that would require certain political groups to disclose expenditures. I think that was the Disclose Act, I think.
Yes. He also voted yes for prohibiting texting while driving, but he voted no for repealing same-day voter registration. And he voted yes, which amended the sexual conduct laws in Montana.
And he voted no to authorize students to bring firearms to school. And he voted no to authorize concealed carry of firearms without a concealed carry permit.
He voted yes for requiring political action committees to disclose their expenditures in reports. And he was a sponsor of funding for teachers' retirement system. Generally, he has a very active legislative record. And as you can see, I guess you would say, a solid Democratic point of view on most of the issues. All right. So to summarize with both candidates, I think it's, again, as it is often in the state this year, pretty clear-cut differentiation. On the one side, you have a relatively ultra-conservative, James Brown, and a relatively centrist Democrat in Tom Woods, running for a public service commission that a lot of people underestimate as to its importance for, and pocketbook issues, for, really, when you talk about rates and so forth for electricity.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, this is one, this public service commission affects every one of us. And, you know, when you open your monthly bills for your phone and for your utilities, that's all being determined by the Public Service Commission and the decisions that they make.
So with that said, we'll move on to the U.S. House of Representatives and the candidates. There are two candidates of note. Of course, the Democratic candidate is Kathleen Williams. The Republican candidate is Matt Rosendale. Both of these names should be fairly familiar because Kathleen ran before against Gianforte for that same position. And Rosendale has been a common name in elections in Montana for some time. So that having been said, Dixie, why don't you start in with a thumbnail of Matt Rosendale?
All right. Matt Rosendale, he was born July 7th in 1960 in Baltimore, Maryland. He was a successful real estate developer, moved to Montana in 2002, and lives just north of Glendive, Montana. He's very active in the Eastern Montana ag community and currently is the Montana State Auditor. His legislative background: in 2010, he ran for Montana House of Representatives on a platform of reducing spending, cutting regulations, gun and property rights, and sanctity of life, which, if you remember, those were the big campaign issues for the Tea Party and the invasion of Republican politics by the Tea Party. He was successful. He defeated the incumbent, Dennis Getz. In 2012, he was elected to the Montana Senate, and he became the Senate Majority Leader in 2014. In 2014, he ran for the U.S. House, losing the primary to Ryan Zinke. And then in 2016, he ran for auditor and defeated Jesse Laslovic. In 2018, he ran for the U.S. Senate, losing to incumbent John Tester. And now in 2019, he announced that he was running for the U.S. House seat again, after Gianforte said he wouldn't run for re-election but was going to run for governor. So we kind of see a pattern here when you lay it out, that as he's holding one office, he runs for another office. And that's consistent. As state auditor, he's also been strongly criticized for pushing junk insurance policies. It's a real issue with him. He has been shilling for the short-term insurance plans that would leave patients out in the cold if they do get sick. The short-term plans typically offer less thorough coverage than the ACA plans, but they're usually cheaper. So people will end up paying for them and purchasing them and then realize that they don't cover a lot of conditions. And he's been criticized for this because, as the auditor, his job is to regulate and oversee insurance in Montana. Even after being criticized, he continues to push these junk insurance policies. Another thing that he has pretty much in his entire political career, from the time he started in 2010, he has been dead set against the Affordable Care Act and claims that if he gets to Washington, the first thing he's going to do is to kill it. He has also been a longstanding opponent to Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, I think he kind of represents two big traditions from the Republican side here. On the one is, of course, he's an ardent supporter of Trump and of the, I guess you could say, far-right conservative wing of the Republican Party. And of the, I guess you could say, Montana tradition of men who made a lot of money somewhere else, moved to Montana, and then ran for office.
Right, right. Well, and then another thing that he's kind of has in common with some of these other Republican candidates is he has strong ties to extremist groups. During his 2018 Senate campaign, he attended a church service conducted by anti-government preacher Chuck Baldwin. And he actually shared the slate with him at an anti-government rally and endorsed his views on his Facebook sites. And this Chuck Baldwin is well known for his horrifying record of discrimination and hate directed at the LGBTQ community, at Muslims, Jews. He blames the Jewish people and their Rothschild tentacles for the horrors of World War I and World War II. And while they were at this rally that Rosendale was at, Baldwin had already described Montana as the tip of the spear in his fight against the government and globalists. He had already connected to the militia movement and called on like-minded white nationals to come to Montana to become the modern-day Alamo in the fight against the government. Also during his 2018 Senate campaign, he gave press credentials and invited the Montana premier militia outfit, Northwest Liberty News, to attend his rally. And of course, the Northwest Liberty News espouses such views as the Parkland High School mass killing was a CIA false flag. You know, you kind of get the picture there. But these are people he's associated with. He's been openly criticized for it, and yet he has not tried to hide it or taken down any of his connections or endorsements to these groups. He's also connected with the Oath Keepers.
Yeah, I think he's another good example of having two tracks to his political career. One part of it is what seems to be a standard business-oriented, develop-oriented Republican view of how things should be run in government. And this other is measured mainly by the company he keeps and the organizations he actually participates in, which tend to be far-right, ultra-extreme right-wing groups.
Ultra-extremists, yes. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about his legislative vote record while he was in the legislature, and I think it just continues to paint a picture of, you know, who we're dealing with. And again, folks, we need to keep in mind that we have got to stop electing people that want to hold a position in government so they can gum up the works.
Yeah, I think we've made this point many times before, and we'll continue to make it, that at best that's a dysfunctional argument. But in times of crises, which we have right now in spades, the idea that you should make government disappear is not only dysfunctional, but crazy. And the people who continue to say that, who continue to follow these right-wing ideas to the extreme, under the circumstances of crises, do not deserve our vote.
Right, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about his legislative voting records. He voted against a bill to establish a water rights compact between the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, the state of Montana, and the United States, which is, most conservationists are in favor of that, and he voted against it. He voted to pass a bill that amends the definition of fishing, hunt, and trap by including the act of harvesting wildlife protected by the laws of the state.
Yeah, and I think in that package you can also say he voted against Medicaid expansion, not surprisingly.
Consistently, yes.
Yeah. He did vote for a bill that specifies that the state prohibition on carrying concealed weapons does not apply to individuals eligible to possess a handgun under the state or federal law, which means, of course, anybody can carry a concealed weapon.
Exactly. That has to be an ALEC bill.
Mm-hmm. He also voted for a bill that prohibits the state and its subdivisions from enforcing federal restrictions on firearms.
And he voted for a bill prohibiting the enforcement of federal firearms regulations.
He did co-sponsor a bill requiring fetal anesthesia for abortions after 20 weeks. And he co-sponsored a bill authorizing firearms on college campuses. And he finally voted for a bill to repeal same-day voter registration.
Right. And he voted for a bill that submits a constitutional amendment to the voters that that clarifies that the Montana Constitution does not grant or secure a right to abortion or the public funding of abortion. And this, again, is one of those gateway bills to try to make abortion illegal. He also voted for a bill that prohibits enforcement of the federal greenhouse gas regulatory program.
Translated, he's not a believer in the climate crisis.
Right, or any of the EPA air quality standards or regulations.
He did vote for a bill that establishes a commission to review any and all federal laws and regulations for constitutionality and possible nullification. Now, that sounds like it. That's a procedural bill, but it's one of those things that in the hands of a particular committee can be used to, as we have said, gum up government, to
right.
make things dysfunctional. He also voted against funding for the new Veterans Home in Butte, and for private and in four privatizing veterans homes in Columbia Falls.
Right. And he voted against a proposal that would have helped veterans buy their first homes. So I think that gives us a pretty good profile of, you know, where exactly Matt Rosendale would stand should he land in the halls of Congress.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a nutshell, he's an ultra-conservative Trump Republican with,
right.
I would say, probably two agendas. One is his public face of supporting development and business in Montana, which is pretty standard Republican, and a less-known agenda, which covers things like extreme positions on firearms, Second Amendment rights, things like that.
Right. And another thing that he lately is supporting on the campaign trail is this idea that the GOP is pushing that would allow businesses to require their employees sign a release of liability against any illnesses or injuries should they contact COVID-19, which is a real disgusting law that they're trying to pass.
Yeah, I think it should be understood that in sending him to Washington, you are going to be sending another very, very closely associated person with Donald Trump. And he talks very glowingly about Trump's victory over COVID. And he supports the Trump wall at the border with Mexico.
Right. Yes, he feels that Donald Trump's done an excellent job with his COVID response.
I think that in a nutshell covers that. Again, you can see that, you know, drawing the contrast, I'm going to switch and talk to about Kathleen Williams' positions now. there's a big contrast, as no surprise. In a nutshell, or in a thumbnail here, Kathleen Williams was born in San Francisco, California, 1961, which makes her 59. She was educated at the University of California, Berkeley, with a Bachelor of Science in Resource Economics, and then went on to Colorado State University, where she received a Master's of Science in Recreational Resources. You can draw from that her background and her interests have been in conservation very, very strongly. She's currently living in Bozeman, Montana. She moved to Montana in 1995, and she has two children, Kaylin and Sander. And her general profession outside of being in politics has been a conservation lab manager. And she's run and or owned various conservation-related laboratories and so forth in Montana. Politically, she's been quite active. She was first elected to the Montana House of Representatives, District 65, in 2011. She served there until 2015, and then she ran for the House of Representatives in District 61 in 2015 to 2017. She gave up that position and ran for the United States House of Representatives, the same one, in 2018, was defeated by Gianforte, and now again she's running for the United States House of Representatives in 2020. I think it's kind of important from a general background. You know, why is she running again for the same office? She was defeated by Gianforte by a little over 20,000 votes, which was the best showing a Democrat has done in almost two decades. And actually, her current status, the election with Rosendale, is rated as a toss-up, which is has not happened in Montana in a long time. So she has accumulated, I would say, a great deal of momentum. She's extremely active as a campaigner and has been, well, she's noted for traveling all over the state in her one vehicle. Rosendale.
Right, in her pickup truck with her faithful sidekick, Danny, who's her hunting dog, a German wire hair pointer. And I think we should mention, too, that she is an avid sportswoman. She's a hunter and she fishes. She hikes.
Yeah, and I think it's represented by some of the organizations she's been a member of. She's been, for example, the associate director of the Western Landowners Alliance, the executive director of the InStream Flow Council, and currently still in these positions, and a member of the Water Pollution Control Advisory Committee. You can tell there's a strong conservation element in her. And I think if you wanted to draw a thumbnail sketch of Kathleen Williams, her political description would be that she is the strongest of all higher office candidates for conservation and land use management, and having both professional and legislative experience. Generally speaking, she's a centrist Democrat with bipartisan instincts and without corporate ties. And that's kind of an important caveat there. I think that people would find that her positions are moderate by Democratic standards. And even though some of the Republicans are now trying to paint her as another radical Democrat.
Right. They Rosendale actually refers to her as the Montana AOC.
Yeah, exactly. Anybody who knows her knows Kathleen Williams. that does not describe her.
Not even close. No. Although I think they would get along very well, but no, they don't.
Yeah,
share
as a
the
political
same.
Description, that's not, you know,
right.
As we would say, not even in the ballpark. I think if you want to know a little bit more about her, we at a podcast runs through it.com. Our website, you can listen to episode 2 with our interview with Kathleen Williams.
Our interview with her covered a lot of ground, including what we've been talking about in this series, which is electing people who know how to use the tools of government to solve problems. Let's listen to a part of the interview where she talks about the danger of losing our democracy if we don't get Congress working again.
This country is built on participation and on process and on fairness and law, the rule of law. And Congress really has abdicated a lot of its authority, whether it's over defense or economic policy or immigration. They've both abdicated their authority or they're not willing to step in and do the difficult work of policymaking. That's their job, and they're not doing it. And there's some systemic reasons, I'm sure, but we need to get people into Congress that know how to do that work, that value that work, and get that institution working again. If you watch hearings, I mean, there's some glimmers of function. But really, they appear to me to be more theater than really deliberation. And if people don't have legislative background that go to Congress, I'm not sure they'll know anything different. So we need to go there and make sure that the hearings are really information exchange, that the proposals are, that there's back and forth, that, you know, the Senate should be taking up some of the proposals or all of the proposals that come out of the House. It's just broken.
I think with her ability to work in a bipartisan way and her skill and experience, she's ready to jump in and help solve one of the biggest crises we're facing as a country today. And that's the crisis of government.
That's right. And I'd like to also mention here that while you're at the podcast, you might want to listen to episode 18, which was Tom Winter, who also ran and was lost the primary to Kathleen. I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more from Tom in the future. So I just wanted to get that in there.
Now, her key issues, as you would expect, I think the perhaps the lead issue for her is her outdoor heritage and defense of conservation. Maybe her second priority has been the health care. She was one of the first people to come up with, especially in Montana, promotion of the idea of people over 55 buying into Medicare. Now, in the current environment with the coronavirus, all of this is changing, and who knows where healthcare will be in the United States legislature in 2021. But her background in healthcare has been to seek ways of extending healthcare rather than limiting it.
Exactly.
She's also had a number of ideas about promoting job creation for higher paying jobs. In other words, trying to attract, I guess what you would call brain industries to Montana to increase the number of jobs, but of a higher paying level. And that's been one of her primary issues. I think one of her quotes, it speaks to me a little bit about where she's coming from. And I think it's to the point. Quote, "I ran because I felt Congress was broken, and I thought it needed people like me with experience who were committed to cutting through the divisiveness and bringing people together. And it's still broken. The divisiveness is still there, the inability to get anything done, but just the inability to function as an institution as intended. Those issues are still there. Healthcare is still there. Public lands issues are still there. Fostering opportunity is still a challenge for some," end quote. Her record, both as a legislator and as a political campaigner, has been to say, "I am a centrist Democrat primarily, and I am willing to work with people who want to get things done."
Exactly, exactly. And she does have some very good and interesting ideas about how to solve the healthcare crisis.
So anyway, as we've been doing with the other candidates, we'd like to go through some of her voting record, the legislation that she has or has not supported, because I think that gives you a quick profile of what she does, not only what she says, but what she does, what she votes for. Let's start with she voted against authorizing tax credits for donations to certain educational programs and student scholarship organizations, which may sound, I'm not sure that's familiar, but that is the, what was it, Dixie?
The tax credits for funding for-profit Christian schools.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. She voted for prohibiting bullying in public schools, which we've mentioned some Republicans voted against. And she voted for expanding healthcare coverage, primarily Medicaid.
And she voted against requiring drug testing for certain welfare recipients. She also voted against amendments regarding concealed weapons regulations.
Yeah, and along the same line, she voted against prohibiting enforcement of certain federal gun restrictions. She voted against authorizing noise suppressors on firearms to hunt non-protected animals. And she voted against establishing tax deductions for donations to educational charities.
And she voted for a bill that would appropriate funds for the teachers' retirement system, and also for a bill to appropriate funds for state employee pay raises. And you might remember that our state employees actually went, I think, for a year or maybe more without pay increases because the state legislature, which was Republican controlled, would not appropriate funds for pay increases. And she voted no on a bill that would repeal same-day voter registration.
But she did vote yes on amendments to the sexual conduct laws of Montana, which may not sound like a big thing, but it was a number of very important changes that are, as you can say, should have been uncontroversial, but weren't.
Right.
She also voted, she voted no against exemption for religious organizations from campaign finance reporting requirements. And she voted no against authorizing students to bring firearms to school.
And she voted yes on a bill that would require disclaimers on election materials. And she voted no on a bill that would establish public charter schools. So public school funds would have gone into public charter schools. And she voted no on that one. And she also voted no on a bill that would prohibit the state from requiring individuals to purchase health insurance.
That is, people might not recall, is part of the Affordable Care Act, which is known as the health insurance mandate.
Right. And I think every Republican state or Republican-controlled legislature in the country tried to move this bill through the legislature that would basically kill the mandate. So
she also voted no against prohibiting enforcement of federal greenhouse gas regulatory programs, which is, again, along the lines of supporting the deregulation of the Environmental Protection Act. She also voted no against requiring ultrasound prior to abortion, but she voted yes for the expansion of elections that can be conducted by mail. You can tell from these, you know, a quick rundown, and this, again, this is not all of the bills that she voted on, but we wanted to go through some of the more representative ones that gives you a flavor of the kind of things she supports and does not support. And you can expect that when she gets to Congress at the United States level, at the federal level, that many of these same issues will reappear and her voting record will be similar to this.
Right.
Anything else you want to add about Kathleen Williams?
I think that pretty much covers it. I, you know, just when I think about Kathleen, I think about somebody that is a Montana politician who can appeal to the entire state. In other words, I think she has a lot of appeal in eastern Montana as well as western Montana. And that's become kind of rare these days.
Yeah, I think she's well known for being an extremely energetic person and, dare I use the word, very good at getting out and meeting people and talking to them. This is difficult in this coronavirus environment where, you know, face-to-face meetings are no longer easy. She still has, her impulse is to get out and meet the people. And I think that it showed in her very strong showing against Gianforte, which I should mention, by the way, that her budget was under $100,000 and his budget was well over $1 million for that election in,
right,
in 2018.
Right.
So that wraps up pretty much our backgrounding on the U.S. House of Representative candidates. I don't think we need to stress here how different they are. I think in many years, the profiles are actually closer together. But this year, in particular, because of the crises we have underway, there are large distinctions between these candidates. And I, for one, really look forward to the debates, which will be happening in, let's see, I think I have a date or two here for that. There are the two debates that have been scheduled so far. Wednesday, September 23rd, House election debates brought to you by PBS. That'll be televised, of course. And then on Saturday, September 26th, a Montana television network will also have House debates. And I look forward to hearing these two candidates actually go at it with over the issues. Well, Dixie, that wraps up pretty much episode 3. Well, we examined the candidates for the Public Service Commission and the candidates for the United States House of Representatives. At this point, we would like to offer our endorsements. As we have said before, the staff at A Podcast Runs Third have considered a lot of information and interviews with these people. This year, there is pretty much an unavoidably clear choice if you have any kind of progressive leanings. And so our endorsements for these two offices are for the Public Service Commission, District 3, Tom Woods, and for the U.S. House of Representatives, Kathleen Williams. You want to add to that, Dixie?
No, I think, you know, and all of us here have done extensive research, but I mean, this one is pretty much an easy choice.
Yeah, I think one of the keys here as we go forward into September and October and up to the election is that the contest between Rosendale and Williams is going to be their response to the coronavirus crisis. Rosendale has pretty much tied himself to Trump and Trump's response to the COVID-19. And, you know, that position has proven to be relatively unpopular, even in Montana, where Williams, from the very beginning, has been a severe critic of Trump and his ongoing denial of the seriousness of the coronavirus crisis. And this will continue to be a pivotal issue as we go forward.
Right, right. And I think Rosendale's extremist positions basically disqualify him from, you know, from pretty much holding any seat of power in government. As we've talked about, we need people who are willing to go in and use the levers of government to solve problems and not to obstruct. So I think that's pretty much a no-brainer there.
And obviously these are, I think as we have gone through these various offices and candidates, this is a dividing line you're going to hear over and over again. And as people keep saying, and there is truth, this is probably the most important election of our lifetimes. And it's precisely because of these kind of differences between the parties and between candidates that voters will have to make up their minds where they go.
Yep. And that's not hyperbole.
No.
And on that note, I think a big reminder that we want to make sure to remind everybody, if you haven't registered to vote yet, get registered as soon as possible.
And if you know anybody who hasn't registered, now's the time. I mean, given the way things are going, it's time to get everything done as early as possible. As we mentioned at the top of this episode, Montana ballots will be coming out in early October. When you get them, don't waste any time. Fill them out and mail them back or return them to your county clerk and recorder's office.
Yes, indeed.
So coming up next, I want to remind everybody that to watch for part 4 of our Montana 2020 general election series. We're going to be discussing the statewide office of Superintendent of Public Instruction and finally, the United States Senate race. I'm Nelson King, along with Dixie Hart. Thanks for listening.